Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors episode 56. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Before we jump into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast. I'm so grateful for your immense generosity. A full list of patrons is available on my website under the Patrons tab. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. November's prize is a copy of The Raven's Widow, a novel of Jane Boleyn by Adrian Dillard. A huge thank you to Adrian for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about Mary Boleyn and the Melusine myth is Christine Morgan. Christine is an historian and teacher from North Carolina who writes and hosts the YouTube series Untitled History Project. She's conducted interviews with best-selling historians and recently published two of her own articles on the myth of Melusine in Medievalists magazine and Medieval Warfare magazine. She was also a featured speaker at the world's first TudorCon in October. Christine wrote her master's thesis on Mary Boleyn at the Tudor court, which was presented at the University of Winchester last year. Christine's working to turn that thesis into a book. Our conversation is coming up straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sayles. Thank you. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Christine. How are you?
I'm so well. How are you, Natalie?
I'm good. I'm really good. I'm really looking forward to chatting with you today. So thank you for agreeing to talk tutors. I thought we could start by you introducing yourself to our listeners and telling us a little bit about your background.
I would love to. Well, I'm just so thrilled to be here. I love this platform and what you're doing and all the wonderful people you've had on. So I'm just honored to be part of this process with you. A little about me. I'm from the States. I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina, where I have been teaching and doing research and completing my master's degree for a couple of years now. Finally got a few of those things behind me. And I specialize in Tudor history. More specifically, my thesis was about Mary Boleyn. And I just recently attended the first ever Tudor Con in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and I got to present some brand new research there that I am hoping I get to talk to you about today.
Fantastic, and a big congratulations on ticking off some of those big items off your to-do list. That's really wonderful. And I did see pictures of the first Tudor Con, and it looked like a lot of fun. So a lot of learning, but a lot of fun alongside it. So that's fantastic. Now, Christine, so what sparked your interest in the Tudors specifically? Was there a moment or a book or something like that?
I don't know if I remember a very specific moment that I started enjoying them. I think I always did. But my story tends to be pretty similar to a lot of people where, you know, you see something that is in pop culture and then you start going down the rabbit holes yourself and you find out sometimes that reality was better than the pop culture, which of course, you know, you love to begin with. So I would say that it's probably a combination of the Showtime series, The Tudors, which was so excellent and fun. And then there was definitely a moment I remember reading some Philippa Gregory books that really just sparked my interest in characters and motivation. So even beyond history, I started to fall in love with the people.
Yeah, and I think for me, it's those wonderful stories, the human stories that I love and that we can connect with, even from such a distance. So I totally understand where you're coming from. So you mentioned that you wrote your master's thesis on Mary Boleyn and the Tudor court, or at the Tudor court, which was presented at the University of Winchester last year. So what drew you to Mary's story in particular?
Again, I would direct initial interest to the other Boleyn girl, not the movies. I actually haven't seen the movies, but I did read the book more than once, and I was just fascinated. In fact, I remember a moment reading that book that was the actual text I was reading when I decided I was going to go back to school and get a graduate degree in history. Wow. I was using history as escapism, and then I just found myself doing all this research, and I thought, well, if I'm going to do the research, I might as well, you know, educate myself and be willing to educate others. So I can credit Ms. Gregory with quite a lot, actually.
Well, that's wonderful, because obviously she's a slightly controversial figure in the world of Tudor history, but I agree with you. If historical fiction, good historical fiction, can inspire further study, and like you said, you've gone on to do a master's degree, that is just wonderful. And I think, you know, all credit to Philippa Gregory for inspiring that love in you. Now, let's talk a little bit about Mary's early life and upbringing. What can you share with us about that?
So Mary's early life, I would say even pretty similarly to Anne's, what we generally know would be maybe some birth dates. We know she's born, I would put it somewhere between 1499 and maybe 1501. She's older than Anne, certainly. But we don't get a whole lot of her early life or education. The first time we really see a primary document that mentions her presence is in 1514, when she's part of then Princess Mary Tudor's entourage to France. She is presumably learning different languages, and she is learning courtly behavior leading up to that event. She certainly would not have been there if she wasn't deserving of that. So we can assume some things about her education level, probably similar things to Anne's. Although Mary's intelligence is not usually one of the things that she gets credited with.
All right. And so I know that it's such a sort of difficult period, that early time, because there just aren't that many documentary sources are there, and there's just little evidence to go on. But when did she arrive at court? When do we know that she's definitely there, back at the English court, I should say?
Back at English court, well, I think a lot of people assume that she returned somewhere in 1520 because of her wedding to William Carey. But during my research, I actually found in one of the state paper documents a reference to the fact that there were multiple ladies Boleyn present for a breakfast. And that was back in November of 1519. Now, we don't see a multiple listing for ladies Boleyn before that, but also it's quite tricky because we don't really know when she left France, because there's a lot of documentation that is missing from that period specifically. So it's not just Mary, but we've lost lots of lovely ladies and their histories. But I kind of believe that we have a November 1519 return of Mary Boleyn at English court. Again, that is a fact that has a couple of different arguments. I guess historians have different reasons why they think she would have come back around that date. One of which was there was a plague in France. So perhaps Mary, being the oldest daughter, perhaps her father pulls her from court and brings her back to England for safety. But I'm not quite sold on that, because then why did he leave Anne, right? Yeah. There's another one. So what I'm actually thinking is Henry VIII reorders his court in 1519, famously called the expulsion of the minions. And with that moment, isn't that great?
That is a great title, isn't it? Gosh.
Even then, that's what they called it. I would imagine that would have had a lot more impact then than even it does now. But at the time, it was assumed that some of his gentlemen in his household who had more French leanings were expelled from his presence. So it's very possible that Thomas Boleyn, with an eldest daughter who was unmarried, is trying to look very, very loyal to Henry VIII. So he says, you know what? I'm going to bring Mary back. We're going to marry her to an English nobleman. And we're going to take advantage of a possible English nobleman who is of high enough rank that he might get put into one of these new job vacancies that has suddenly opened up. And so that's kind of what I think happened. So Mary is back in England certainly by November 1519 and conveniently married to one of Henry VIII's relatives by 1520.
And I'd love to hear more about the woman that you discovered in your research, because there's so many myths surrounding, well, the whole Boleyn family, but Mary Boleyn as well. What was she like, and what did her contemporaries think of her?
That is such a good question, and it's so perfect, because we just talked about how much we love the human aspect of these stories. For me, what I discover with Mary is completely the opposite of the perception that people have of her when they write, or at least the perception they have had more recently. There are elements of Mary Boleyn that I think are strongly tied to religious reform. It can be difficult to track her and to track her own voice, right? Because there's so few documents. But the ones that do exist really give me a picture of a young woman who was indignant and bold, and she knew that she had privilege in this world, and she was going to use it. And she made several good marriages, one of them for love. And I very honestly believe that her language, at least in her 1534 petition to Thomas Cromwell, her language is very self-assured. It is unapologetic. And, you know, at that point, she's a woman in love. And I think it makes her so human, so flawed, and yet she's confident. And I love that about her.
Yeah, that's wonderful, isn't it? It's very different to the Mary Boleyn that we often see portrayed in popular culture. But I think now researchers and wonderful historians like yourself are doing so much work to bring the more human and flawed, as you said, Mary Boleyn to light. So that's really fascinating. Now, we've already mentioned that the Boleyn family, Mary and the Boleyn family, is shrouded in this sort of myth and all these things we see in popular culture, etc. What do you think is one of the most persistent myths, I suppose, if you can choose one out of all?
Oh my goodness. I think that both Boleyn sisters get a really bad reputation with this word, whore. Isn't that just the beauty of it? I don't think either of them were that, but they are just so central to propaganda at the time. Whether the propaganda is about Anne and her previous exploits, or the propaganda shifts to Mary to say, oh, well, she, you know, she had an affair in France and she had an affair with Henry, and if he marries Anne, then it's incest. You know, they're just pulled into these sexual stories so frequently. And I'm not saying they're not all true, but I am saying that perhaps it got blown out of proportion, especially for two women so associated with the Reformation. They're so entrenched and well-versed, you know. Even Mary, she's advocating for the elevation of nuns in nunneries, and she's writing with these words that really bring us back into these early translations of Tyndale's Bible. They were entrenched in religious reform circles, and yet pop culture, even then, is calling them whores. It kills me.
Yeah, that is a very persistent one. I think you hit the nail on the head there. We're going to shift our focus now, Christine, and I'm really excited to talk to you about the Melusine myth and how queens like Elizabeth I used it as propaganda. But I think we have to go back and sort of begin with the basics for me more than anything. Who was Melusine and where do we see her now?
Such a good question. Who was Melusine? Well, as far as I can tell, she's completely made up, but she is so expertly woven into real life events that I can see why she became so popular during her time. She emerges in the Hundred Years' War and then is picked up by noble families and royal families all across Europe. And she's usually used by women of royal or noble blood to perpetuate some sort of vision of strength or capability. And she is French in origin, but many different cultures will translate and then adapt and even edit the initial story, which is a poem, to reflect their own culture. In terms of where we might see her today, we'll certainly talk about evidences in historical documents, but I would say every morning when you grab your cup of Starbucks coffee, she is a bright green mermaid smiling back at you.
Wow, I've never even thought about that. That's so fascinating. Love that. And so was she popular in Tudor times then?
She certainly was. This is something I'm still exploring. And Natalie, this is an in-process research moment for me, but I'm so in love with it. I love talking about it. But it's typical that an image like Melusine, which is sometimes mermaid, can mean a couple of different things, but for Tudor royals and nobility, again, it's used as a symbol of strength. So you have two sides of the coin. If you are a peasant, it's usually witchcraft and prostitution. If you're a noble, it is power and strength.
And how does this form part of the greater Tudor story, I suppose?
There is a wonderful association between Melusine, who, by the way, was born in 1393, conceptualized yeah, in 1393. And there's a wonderful association with her and with water. She is typically a magical creature that transforms in water, but she has other really great qualities that make her powerful. Like, she's very fertile, she's a great architect, she's great at expanding her territory. So she's associated with water and with all those other things. So when we get to the Tudors, especially people like Henry VIII and then later his daughter Elizabeth I, naval power is going to be really important. And that's why we see Melusine popping up there.
That's really fascinating. And is there a link? I'm kind of in my brain, Elizabeth Woodville just popped into my head. Is there a link with them as well, or is that from some popular culture story that I've probably read?
No, I think that's such a great question because she has appeared, or that association has been made in historical fiction. Again, that goes back to Philippa Gregory, who did that really expertly in one of her own books. But the Woodvilles, they are associated with this myth. Actually, Elizabeth Woodville's mother, Jacquetta of Luxembourg, frequently referred to Melusine as being part of her family tree. And that was pretty typical. Like I said, these noble families really grabbed this myth and some of them, honestly, put it in their family line and said they were descendant from this Melusine myth. And Jacquetta of Luxembourg was one of those, and she was later put on trial for possible witchcraft. Elizabeth Woodville was not put on trial for that, but she's frequently associated with the myth as well.
How fascinating. Now, you mentioned, obviously, the association with water and how that might link to, you know, Elizabeth I and her reign and the expansion and the Armada and all that sort of stuff. So can we go into this a little bit more? Talk to us a little bit more about how Elizabeth used it, but do we know of any other Tudors who used it?
At this point in time, my answer is no.
I know.
But I'll tell you, this is a really interesting research method for me because it is going to end up being very visual. So I'm going through portraiture, I'm going through sketches, I'm going through coats of arms, and I'm looking for this mermaid image. I see in Elizabeth I, she uses either a picture of a mermaid or a version of a serpent, a water serpent, in at least three portraits of herself. But I don't see that with Henry VIII. And frankly, it's a little surprising from Elizabeth, just because she's so tied to her mother, and her mother was so vilified for witchcraft ideas. So for Elizabeth to use this, it must have been above the witchcraft suspicion at the time. Yeah, isn't that fun?
It is a lot of fun. And can I just say, Christine, just to clarify for people listening, that Anne was never, ever charged with witchcraft. I know that you're meaning the association that comes in Elizabeth's reign, but I just don't want anyone listening to get mixed up and think that, because, you know, that's something that I know that I've been trying to blow out those trick birthday candles and they just don't go out. So, and the association with witchcraft and Anne obviously comes later with enemies of Elizabeth, namely Nicholas Sander, to be honest, who decides that, you know, who paints Anne as this horrid thing with all sorts of deformities and, you know, so that association comes a little bit later, but I know exactly what you mean. Sorry, just to interrupt you there.
No, please clarify all you need. Yes, it's absolutely untrue.
Yeah, that's great. So how else is this? So obviously, I really do hope you find, it sounds like fascinating research and going through all those images, and I hope you find some other tutors that have used it, and we'll certainly keep an eye out for you as well when we're going through things. But how else has the myth been used just throughout history in general?
Throughout history in general, I certainly see evidence of use with Isabella of Castile, which would then potentially lead me to Catherine of Aragon. She is on the list. But Isabella was a fabulous conqueror of territory. We think of Granada, we think of exploration and Columbus, and she is leading the charge with many of those efforts, and she's doing so successfully. She's expanding her territory, and then she's part of that age of water exploration. So those things make her very masculine. So how do we balance masculinity of conquering with the cultural need for women to be feminine? And Melusine is the perfect propaganda for Isabella, because Melusine has all these children. She's incredibly fertile. And then she puts all of her children in charge of the territories that she conquers. So she doesn't just take land. She then allows her children, at least her sons, to take control of that land. And she's got a wonderful husband, and they co-rule in the myth. So for Isabella and her co-ruler, Ferdinand, I mean, this was just the perfect thing.
Oh, my goodness. It's like written for them, isn't it? Like just thinking about all their children that ended up, you know, in the ruling houses all over Europe. So it That's amazing.
Exactly, exactly. So we know Isabella is using it and using it well. But the flip side of that coin, like I mentioned earlier, is if you're not a royal or noble woman, you're probably being accused of something. And we actually see evidence of this with the trial records of even Joan of Arc during the Hundred Years' War. And she's accused of dancing with fairies and visiting a well, so there's our water source. And a lot of the trial records would indicate that they were trying to get her to admit to believing in or even worshiping some sort of mythical creature very similar to Melusine. So it's a tough double standard.
Obviously, you've devoted, and I can see and continue to devote, a lot of time to researching the Tudors and this topic that you're researching now. Can you talk to us a little bit more about how you're conducting your research? You've mentioned you're going to go through, you know, lots and lots and lots of visual history, and what you hope to achieve in the future.
Well, I'm going to try something new.
Ooh, excellent.
I was so inspired by the idea of TudorCon, this sort of meeting of the minds. And I do a lot of advocacy for historians who are maybe not located near these wonderful European or UK archives. You know, there's lots of digital history that's accessible. So for me, I'm kind of conducting research on my own with my own skills, but I'm crowdsourcing a little bit too. And you would not believe the interesting things people send me when they know what to look for. I had someone that I actually just met a couple weekends ago was taking a trip and went to the Metropolitan Museum and sent me pictures of about three different things where this Melusine mermaid or serpent figure appears. And they were three things I had had no information about prior to that. So the more that people can see it and recognize it and let me know about it, the better my understanding of how the myth was used, and the better my book will be when I write it.
Isn't that fantastic? And I've said this before, I have a Facebook group associated with this podcast, Talking Tudors, on Facebook, and it's a group, and it's nearing, you know, the 5,000 mark, and it's wonderful, and people are so knowledgeable and so open and willing to share, and I've learned so much from that group. I've spent a long time studying Tudor history, and there's still new stuff that's coming up all the time. And as you say, I sort of feel now, because the group is made up of people from all over the world, and it's kind of like eyes and ears everywhere now. So people send all these wonderful things, you know, and it's not just, Tudor history isn't just in England. There's lots of wonderful stuff that's all over the world. However, it's ended up there, that's another story. But and people are writing about this stuff and sending it. So we're all learning from each other. So I think there's so much value in what you're doing.
I'm so glad you see it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you can't be everywhere at the same time. So of course, if people are willing to help and share and then, of course, be properly credited in your final work, then I think it's wonderful.
Absolutely. I think crowdsourcing a history book would be fascinating. Truly. Yeah,
How would you see that? Well, I want to hear a little bit more about that. So when you say crowdsourcing, what do you mean exactly?
So when you're walking around and you're taking a tour of something and you're looking at a portrait or a painting or you're reading a history book and all of a sudden you see a mermaid, I want to know about it.
Well, you are now, because you're the first person that's going to pop into my head whenever I see it.
I know. And those sources, you know, when I picture a crowd-sourced piece of knowledge, usually it's people just making other people aware of the existence of sources that are already on display, which is wonderful. So I actually don't know yet, Natalie, how I would go about doing crediting or something like that. But I think it needs to be done. I think it's time, because people are so knowledgeable now.
Absolutely.
And so curious. I really wish there was another way to get everyone involved.
I also wanted to just quickly ask you, apart from the Starbucks reference that I love now, is it used, in any other ways kind of now? Or is that the main one that you know of?
That is certainly the most visible.
Yes.
And they've used it. I don't even know if they know why they've used it. It definitely has to do with shipping and trade prowess. Okay. Yeah. But I'm not even really clear if they know where it originated. But it still is water-based, which is funny. So that piece has never gone away. I'm not immediately thinking of anything incredibly modern. Our version of her has certainly altered into like a real mermaid. So it's been a little perverted visually.
Well, now, Christine, you've got all the Talking Tudors listeners that are going to keep their eye out for any sign of Melusine or Melusine myth anywhere, and we'll get that information to you. So that's fantastic. And I've so loved hearing about your research. It's very different to other research that I've spoken to other people about. So it's wonderful. It's quite unique. And I can't wait to hear more about it and more about your book.
Oh, thank you so much. This has been really, really fun.
Thank you. And I can't let you go yet, though. So don't run away yet, because we always play a little game of 10 to go. I like to call it 10 to go. And these are questions really just to get to know you a little bit better. And the feedback I get is that this is one of the favorite parts of the interview for people. So people obviously enjoy finding out more about the guests. So, Christine, are you ready to do that?
I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
Excellent. So number one, this one hopefully will be quite easy. What was the last book that you bought?
Oh, I just bought a book from my friend Dan Jones, who just released his book on the Crusaders. Oh. And I am really excited to dive into that.
Excellent. That sounds good. I just saw something on Twitter about that today, actually. Number two, what music do you enjoy?
Well, I'm from the American South, and I really do honestly listen to country music.
And it's so great. I love country music. Yeah.
I would definitely say it leans more towards the singer-songwriter country, but I don't think that makes it any better.
Fabulous country music. And what is your drink of choice? If a friend's taking you out, what do they buy you?
Oh, bourbon.
Excellent.
They're buying me bourbon.
Fantastic. We all know now, if we ever take you out for a drink, bourbon. Do you have any guilty pleasures that you're willing to share, even if you're not so guilty about it, which is what people seem to tell me? I'm not guilty.
Oh, wow. Guilty pleasures. Oh, gosh, Natalie, it's hard when you don't feel bad about
that's
it.
That's right. I know, exactly.
Yeah, I love Parks and Recreation. I can watch at least a couple episodes every day if I ever have time. That's what I'm doing.
Oh, I didn't know. What is that? I don't know that.
Oh, it's a television show that's been off the air for a while, but it's on American Netflix, and it's about a woman who works for a small government in Indiana, and it follows her story. It's like a sitcom, sort of.
Okay, there you go. Never knew about that. So number five, have you ever binge-watched a series? And if so, you've just told me one. Maybe you've got another one.
Yeah.
If so, what was it?
I've binge-watched a lot of series. right now, I'm watching the new release of Jack Ryan. I have binge-watched Stranger Things. So good. And I do actually believe I binge-watched The Tudors before it was called binge-watching.
There you go. So you're quite familiar with binge-watching then, Christine.
I think so.
All right, fabulous.
I don't know what that says about me.
No, it's all good. We all do it. Have you ever dreamt of any Tudor personality?
Oh, I'm sure I have. I have to tell you, though, I really wouldn't remember it.
Oh, you don't remember dreams, yeah.
I don't remember dreams. I'm sure I have, and I just can't tell you about it.
I know. It's like my husband. He complains because he can't really remember anything about his dreams. And I literally almost, you know, every day wake up writing pages and pages from what I've dreamt.
Wow.
And he can't believe it. I remember faces, conversations, books, you know, all sorts of details. And he's just like, why can't I remember one thing? So... there you go.
Wow, what a treat. That's very lucky.
It is a treat. I do feel very lucky. And I, like I say to him, I think you have to go to bed with the intention, okay, I'm going to remember my dreams. And then the minute you wake up, like, you cannot delay. You have to either say it, so it's kind of there, or write it. Otherwise, it disappears. It's like, yep, it's just gone.
That's a hot tip.
A hot tip, yeah, from Natalie Grudiger about dreaming. Don't ask me what expertise I have in that, but there you go.
I love.
What was the last film that you watched?
I went and saw the Downton Abbey movie.
Oh, I haven't seen that yet. Was it good?
I really enjoyed it. It's what I wanted it to be.
Oh, good. I'm so glad to hear that. I do need to watch that. Number 8, describe your ideal Saturday night.
I've probably ordered delivery.
Yeah, sounds good.
I'm probably having a glass of wine, and I have a friend over, and we are just sort of recapping the week. That would be ideal.
Do you have a favorite childhood memory that you're willing to share with us?
Oh, the first thing that comes to mind would be, and this is probably actually a major factor in why I am the way that I am, but my mother used to actually wake me up every once in a while, even if it was a school day. She'd say, instead of going to school today, we're going to go in search of something beautiful. And she would take me to a museum or to a play or to some sort of creative arts something, a calligraphy class. I'm remembering a few just off the top of my head. Tea time. And she was really great about that. She saw that there was value in education about cultures and other things than math and science. And I really think that shaped me.
Oh my goodness, that's so beautiful. I've never heard anything quite like that. And I just think, wow, what a wonderful mother to offer you those experiences that, as you say, sometimes are not valued in the school curriculum, unfortunately. So, yeah, that is so beautiful. I love that. Absolutely.
You
love
should
that.
Try it.
Yes, I'm thinking. I know. Well, my daughter's 15 now, so it's a little trickier.
Oh, I know.
It's a tricky age, that one, I tell you. My son's 11. He's. I think I could get away with it with him. Like he loves all that stuff. But yeah, 15 is an odd age. But that's a whole other podcast, I think, that one.
I would listen to that too, though. That sounds like it would be eye-opening, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's one way of putting it. No, she's a good girl, and I'm very grateful for my children. So I have to just add that in there. And lucky last, as you're well aware, Christine, there's so much that remains undiscovered about the Tudors. So many questions we have, and you know, I think. I'm trying to remember that I was told that I think it's only around 20% of the National Archives and at Kew that have been kind of really, that have been looked at all, actually, I think is what one of my guests said. So there's just so much waiting to be discovered. What's a find or a discovery that you'd love to make yourself personally?
I would love to find some sort of personal artifact wedged between pages.
Ooh. Yes.
Some sort of like double or triple significance whammy. That would be amazing. Or maybe something that maybe has a watermark. Maybe that's my love of National Treasure movies. Some sort of watermark or hidden ink something. That would be really fun.
I can't believe you just mentioned watermark because I am absolutely obsessed at the moment.
Really?
With watermarks. In fact, I just spent quite a lot of money ordering some books that I'm hoping are going to give me a little bit of information. I can't give it away just yet because it's going to be in my next book, but a little bit of kind of juicy detail information about a very famous Tudor and a letter that he wrote. But anyway, well, and it's got to do with watermarks. That's so funny. I'm taking that as a sign, Christine, that I'm on the right track and there are good things to find. But I love your what you want to discover. And when you do discover it, can you let me know, please?
You'll be the first to know.
Thank you. Now, before I let you go back to what you were doing this evening, what is the Tudor takeaway that you have? I always ask my guests for something for our listeners to go off and explore. And we've had websites and books and films to watch and music and all sorts of amazing things. So do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
I do. Can I have Yay. Two?
Oh, yes, takeaways? Please. I love when guests say that. Yes, you certainly can.
I would say my first Tudor takeaway is go up and take a look at the free, wonderful free online courses and resources with historic royal palaces, run by the fabulous Tracy Borman and Lucy Worsley and their amazing team. They have courses and educational opportunities there that are so, so beautifully done. And I encourage everyone to go check those out. And then a little more specifically, for your viewers who are maybe on the European continent or in the UK and have access, I would just really love to suggest two conferences that are really wonderful. Historic Royal Palaces will be doing one this year, focusing on the field of cloth of gold and different pieces of history all around that, and that'll be this summer. And then there's also another conference called the Kings and Queens Conference, where you can go and learn history that people are doing research about that has to do with all different kings and queens and nobility from Europe. And it is an incredible event.
They sound wonderful. Are you attending either of those?
Oh, I hope so. I hope I'll be invited to both of those.
Oh, fantastic.
Fingers crossed. We'll see.
All right. Well, I can't wait to hear more. And funnily, I saw the wonderful conference on the field of cloth of gold that, of course, I was like drooling. And I couldn't believe when I checked the dates, because it appears that it's the weekend after I fly out of London.
Oh, no. That's terrible luck.
I know. And I thought about rearranging everything, but I don't think it's going to happen. And I was just so upset. But anyway, it doesn't matter. I'm doing wonderful things in the fortnight that I am there, so I can't complain. But yeah, I did see that and think, oh, no.
What a great event that's going to be.
Oh, it sounds incredible. And I love the field of cloth of gold and learning about, you know, all the portable palaces and all that sort of thing. So I guess we'll have to live vicariously through you, Christine. You can update us on what's happening there.
Yeah, well, knock on wood.
I'm knocking on wood and keeping fingers and toes crossed. Now, Christine, it's been so wonderful chatting with you, and I thank you for taking the time to talk Tudors with me.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was the best part of my day. I would do it every day.
Oh, that's so lovely. Thank you so much, and enjoy the rest of your day.
You too.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you will also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.